Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
At the end of every year, I do this year in review broadcast, and I recap some of the biggest events from all around the world, you know, election news and scientific discoveries and what the celebrities are up to and famous people who passed away. We do a news of the weird segment. And every year when I'm prepping that particular broadcast, I always find myself navigating what is almost always an American story. It's this series of mass shootings. So I'll go through month by month. There's a mass shooting. There's a mass shooting. There's a mass shooting. What do I do? Do I stick those in every month? Do I package them together and do like a mass shooting recap? And I'm struck by the insanity of it. It's a mass shooting segment? And I look at the locations. Geographically, it's the United States, United States, United States, United States. In just the month of May, we've been talking about two major events. Buffalo, New York, May 14th. A white supremacist domestic terrorist posts this 180-page hate-filled manifesto. And the manifesto was protesting white replacement theory. So he posts this online, and then he drives 200 miles to go and mow down 10 people. He kills 10. He injures 3 others at a Buffalo, New York supermarket. And he live streamed the whole thing. Almost all of his victims were black. Now, if you're not familiar with white replacement theory, this has been around for a long time. It's this notion that Western elites, and yes, even the Jews, are bringing in immigrants to the United States. This is part of a sinister plot to replace white people with non-whites. There is now an existential threat to white people. And of course, in the United States, we are seeing that whites as a demographic are becoming less and less prominent, right? We're becoming more and more a spectrum of color and culture in the U.S. Well, if you're a white nationalist, a white Christian nationalist, a white supremacist, you are freaking out. We are no longer going to be at the head of the table. So this fringe conspiracy theory is a way to vilify and dehumanize and oppose these non-whites who want to come and essentially wipe out the white people. This is nothing new. This roots back to French nationalism. We saw white replacement theory as part of Hitler's Nazi Germany in the 1930s and 40s, right? What was that other than white replacement theories? They're coming to displace and replace us. They must be destroyed, okay? They're coming to get us, so we must get them first. And that's what this killer in Buffalo, New York was thinking, and that supposedly excused his assassination, his massacre of 10 people, mostly non-whites, in New York. Well, only days later, May 24th, Tuesday, an 18-year-old shot and severely wounded his grandmother, and then he drove to Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, and executed with an AR-15 19 children and 2 teachers. He had 2 AR-15s purchased at a federally licensed store, which was 3 miles from the school. He bought the guns on 2 separate days, and he bought them legally. And the murderer was killed by police in a shootout. So here we go again. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted This was a mental health issue and a spiritual war. Quote, we don't need more gun control. We need to return to God. Arizona Republican Representative Paul Gosar posted, and then he quickly deleted this post, a tweet that blamed the Texas school massacre on, quote, a transsexual leftist illegal alien. And he did this just after users on 4chan had falsely claimed that the killer was trans. Oh, and then we have Texas Senator Ted Cruz, and isn't he always a joy? He was pressed by a journalist from Sky News on gun reform after the massacre. Here's the audio.
There are 19 sets of parents who are never going to get to kiss their child goodnight again.
Is this the moment to reform gun laws?
You know, it's easy to go to politics.
But it's important. It's at the heart of the issue.
I get that that's where the media likes to go.
No, it's not. It's where many of the people we've talked to here like to go.
The proposals from Democrats in the media, inevitably, when some violent psychopath murders people.
A violent psychopath who's able to get a weapon so easily. 18-year-old with two AR-15s.
If you want to stop violent crime. The proposals the Democrats have, none of them would have stopped this.
But why does this only happen in your country? I really think that's what many people around the world just, they cannot fathom. Why only in America? Why is this American exceptionalism so awful?
You know, I'm sorry you think American exceptionalism is awful.
I think this aspect of it.
You get your political agenda.
No, it's
God,
honestly,
God love you.
Senator, it's not. I just want to understand why you do not think that guns are the problem.
Why is this just an American problem?
I could go on and on here. There were so many public statements by awful people saying awful things. And then they say, well, we shouldn't politicize an issue that everybody else is politicizing. When actually, one, they are also politicizing it. And how can this not be part of our political discourse? Especially seeing how American mass shootings went from an average death toll of 8 deaths per year in the 1970s to an average of 51 per year by 2019. And of course, every mass shooting is immediately followed by the same language. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the victims. Pray for us. We pray for everyone. Thoughts and prayers. Even when President Biden made his official statement about the need for national gun reform and a changing of our ideas about this national notion of firearms, in that statement, he used the language of prayer. We pray for the families of the victims. He quoted scripture. The Lord is near to the brokenhearted and saves the crushed in spirit. Okay. On one level, I get it. I get this, okay? Having been a former religious guy, devout Christian, I get that. Biden being a devout Catholic, religious people are trained by culture and doctrine to speak their words of comfort in this way. I'm praying for you. You're in my prayers. And many times this comes from a genuine and good place. It's part of how you are, for lack of a better word, programmed to show empathy and goodwill in times of trouble. So I'm not so cynical as to dismiss everybody who says, I'm praying for you. Okay? They're not all just empty, lazy, insincere platitudes. Sometimes they are part of a genuine expression of goodwill. I think it's fair to say that. But if we look at thoughts and prayers from the more objective vantage, thoughts and prayers are useless. Just useless. Just empty words. Sometimes a lazy excuse to do nothing. Oh, I'm praying for you. Well, I've actually now done something substantive. I offered up my words into the aura, into the ether, into the spiritual membrane out there, and they will then transfer to you and make some difference. It took me about 12 seconds and no actual effort, but now I can pat myself on the back because I have sent you my thoughts and prayers, right? What does this solve? What does it solve to send thoughts and prayers to the families of massacred children? Oh, look, The NRA, the National Rifle Association, released an official statement, quote, "Our deepest sympathies are with the families and victims involved in this horrific and evil crime. On behalf of our members, we salute the courage of school officials, first responders, and others who offered their support and services. Although an investigation is underway and facts are still emerging, we recognize that this was the act of a lone, deranged criminal. As we gather in Houston, we will reflect on these events, pray for the victims, recognize our patriotic members, and pledge to redouble our commitment to making our schools secure." By the way, this is loaded language because there is a thinking among the NRA culture that the way to protect kids in school is to arm the schools, like arm teachers and superintendents and counselors, and some people think you even arm the students themselves. The solution to gun violence is more guns. That's the thinking. And how often do the Second Amendment warriors, the absolutists, really, excuse gun cults like the NRA by using thoughts and prayers as a substitute for actual policy and change? Now, sometimes I think we want to put this massive problem in a box. And I've seen this out there. And I don't think it's unfair to say that there are some people that say, well, if you ban guns, we solve the problem. Other people say, well, if we solve the mental health issues that we have, problem solved. I don't think that works either. I mean, it doesn't fit in a box. I'm saying it's a huge part of the conversation. But for people like me, I think we have to talk about both. We have to talk about other and all factors. This includes also a hard conversation about assault-style weapons that are readily and immediately available to almost anyone and everyone who wants to get their hands on one. And already I can see the AR-15 crowd, and they're having a fit, and they're sending their hate mail my direction. Fine, go ahead. Now, I used to be that guy. I didn't own an AR-15, didn't want to own one, didn't really care. But I had reduced everything to, well, it's just the intent to kill that kills, and the weapon could be anything. And I've modified my approach to this because I have become impressed that the embracing of guns, the linking of guns to the national identity, the ubiquity of guns, and this constant notion that guns are necessary to protect ourselves against the horde of whoever, you know, our own government or the immigrants or the foreigners or whatever's going, communists, socialists, they're all coming. We're going to need our guns. I used to be that guy back in my Fox News day, and I have modified my position on it. And I'm glad for that. I think we should all be evolving our positions and hopefully improving them whenever we can, right? Let's all be creatures of positive change, okay? Well, on top of all the recent headlines, at Only Sky, a psychologist, his name is Lincoln Andrews, he posted an article in the wake of the suicide by gun of country music legend Naomi Judd. And he wanted to talk about gun suicides and public health. And he named me in the first few sentences of the article. That's totally fine. That's totally fair. The reason that he mentioned me is because it's public knowledge that I own two pistols. And I use them for target shooting on rare occasions. Okay, and I'm coming back to that. And I think he was trying to say, look, I'm not coming after everybody who's a gun owner. Seth Andrews, host of The Thinking Atheist, who I think's a reasonable guy. That's kind of how I read it. He has firearms. So I think he was trying to assuage the fears of gun-owning secular humanists. And yes, there are quite a few out there, okay? But he wanted to have a hard discussion about American notions of firearms in relation to public health and safety. So after he posted the article, I just wanted to elaborate and say clearly, I only target shoot. I am licensed and trained. I keep both weapons securely locked in a gun safe that is totally inaccessible to anybody else. I, as a gun owner, hate the NRA. I hate the NRA. I think the whole idea of civilian assault weapons is stupid. ridiculous. My guns are not linked to my personal or my national identity, and perhaps most controversially, yes, I would be willing to surrender my firearms as part of a national health and safety mandate. And that idea makes the Second Amendment warriors go crazy. I can't believe Seth Andrews says he would surrender his guns if the government asked him to do it. Okay, well, a few years ago, when I published my book, Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian, I wrote an entire chapter about American gun culture. I think it is fair, I think it's well-defended, it's nuanced, it's thoughtful, it's strong, and I think it's just as relevant today as it was then. So the rest of this broadcast is that chapter. I want to play it for you in the hopes that you will listen to it fairly, that you will discuss the points I'm making, disagree with the points I'm making, have a reasonable, thoughtful, mature, adult conversation about the unique linking of guns with the American identity under the shadow of these nearly constant headlines about mass murders perpetrated with very often legally obtained AR-15s. Now, I need to take a real short break so I can read that chapter uninterrupted. Stand by. I'll be right back after this. Okay, chapter 7 from my book, Confessions of a Former Fox News Christian. It's titled, Out of My Cold, Dead Hands, America's Love Affair with Guns. In March 2019, I was invited to speak at an Atheist Day rally at the State Capitol grounds in Austin, Texas. Most of the presenters were addressing state-church separation and the rise of America's non-religious voting bloc. As I waited for my turn at the microphone, I noticed a group of men lingering near the periphery of the crowd, men who looked quite out of place for an Atheist Day assembly. I focused my eyes toward them. I counted 9 people between the approximate ages of 20 and 60, many of them wearing military clothing, most packing firearms, including one guy with an AR-15 slung over his shoulder. 2 men held up a large banner bearing the phrase, "Don't tread on me." All of the men were white. One of my colleagues engaged them to find out what was happening. Well, this small group had assembled at the state capitol to protest the upcoming vote on new gun safety initiatives in Texas. House Bill 316 promoted suicide prevention and a public campaign for safe gun storage. House Bill 1207 required prompt reporting of lost or stolen guns. House Bill 1208 would create a path where county courts could force the surrender of weapons. House Bill 1236 would ban even legal firearms on college campuses. And House Bill 2280 would allow for clear signage by business owners forbidding handguns in stores and offices. Apparently, this small band of demonstrators felt that these bills, which seemed perfectly reasonable to me, were an assault on their individual liberties and a violation of the U.S. Constitution's Second Amendment. Don't tread on me. The Second Amendment remains one of the most hotly debated issues in the United States, and the arguments themselves reveal how deeply guns are embedded in American notions about freedom and liberty. The Second Amendment of the Constitution declares a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. America has long cradled its firearms with more guns than citizens. Handguns, shotguns, rifles, semi-automatics, fully automatics. More than 11 million new firearms are manufactured every year, not including those made for the military. I'm included in U.S. gun statistics. I have 2 pistols of my own. There are a lot of misconceptions about American gun owners. the laziest one lumping all of them into a giant rusty pickup truck with a Confederate flag flapping from the antenna. The internet is loaded with videos of unqualified, reckless, or outright dangerous people pulling the trigger on some unfortunate outcome. And while those alarming examples do exist, they often have the effect of drawing the big picture in caricature. It seems unbelievable to many, but there is a huge percentage of gun owners that abhors violence, received proper firearms training, uses every safety precaution, and treats deadly weapons with the care and respect they deserve. Their guns are for recreation and/or for home protection, in controlled environments, purchased legally, and handled with temperance. Many gun owners even refuse to hunt, opting for paper targets at a local shooting range. And, believe it or not, many American gun owners hate the National Rifle Association. I was 30 years old when the NRA knighted its newest leader, the legendary actor Charlton Heston. Heston's Hollywood resume was long and distinguished, with his most famous roles in big-budget Bible epics like Ben-Hur and the Ten Commandments. When I first saw the Ten Commandments on my parents' modest television as a teenager, I was blown away, and Charlton Heston's Moses remains my favorite version of the character. No doubt Heston's on-screen nobility informed the public perception of him, and he carried his film image as emancipator into his political life. A former political lefty, Charlton Heston had become disenfranchised with the Democratic Party, switching to Republican in the 1980s and becoming a fierce campaigner for President Ronald Reagan, Bush 1, and Bush 2. His activism also coincided with conservative concerns about a shift in American culture. The 1980s saw a lot of pulpit pounding about the moral decline of a generation, immoral songs on the radio, immoral films in the theaters, immoral shows on the television, immoral books in the retail stores, the rise of progressivism, the growing influence of non-Christians. Religious, political organizations like the Moral Majority fretted about the national assault on traditional values. Tipper Gore's Parents Music Resource Center, the PMRC, was demanding parental advisory stickers on explicit albums to protect children. And American Christians had spun themselves into hysterics about satanic influence in music, movies, television, games, toys, and even cartoons. I described this satanic panic in a speech I gave in 2017 in Orlando, Florida, at the Florida Freethought Conference. That speech is easily found on YouTube. Charlton Heston was outraged about the slippery slope of permissiveness being foisted onto a once great nation. He publicly and rightly denounced the 1992 Ice-T song Cop Killer as a contemptuous attempt to sell shock to the American people. Against the outcry, Ice-T pulled the song from the album. In 1997, Heston wrongly told an audience at the Free Congress Foundation that God-fearing, white, straight, heterosexual gun owners were being persecuted by liberals via cultural warfare. Defending the Second Amendment 3 years later at Brandeis University in Massachusetts, he laughably aligned gun control advocates with McCarthyism and proclaimed that, quote, political correctness is tyranny with manners. Moses had spoken. God despised liberals. God loved the NRA. The National Rifle Association was founded in 1871. To, quote, promote and encourage rifle shooting on a scientific basis. The focus was competitive marksmanship and proper safety training. The NRA was created partly as a response to Civil War statistics that showed that Union soldiers had been startlingly bad at hitting their enemy targets. Simply, they couldn't shoot straight. Rifle ranges were established, and riflemen set to honing their skills. Throughout the early to mid-20th century, various gun regulations were installed by the federal government in response to the growing gun culture. The Tommy Gun gangsters of the 1930s inspired federal regulation of machine guns. And the assassinations of President John Kennedy, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. prompted the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act and the Gun Control Act of 1968, significantly restricting gun sales and shoring up the protocols for licensing a firearm. In the 1980s, gun violence seared itself into the public debate. President Ronald Reagan was shot and wounded by John Hinckley Jr. in 1981. White House Press Secretary James Brady had been permanently disabled with a bullet to the head, and incidents of gun violence surged among the population throughout the 1980s and early 1990s, peaking in 1993. Amid growing public concerns about gun violence and the institution of stricter gun laws, required background checks, a 10-year federal ban on assault weapons, etc., the National Rifle Association got political, and its primary weapon for opposing gun restrictions was the Second Amendment, a tool waved proudly by NRA frontmen like Charlton Heston. The NRA and many American gun owners framed the gun debate under the larger umbrella of personal liberty, freedom, and constitutionally protected, God-ordained rights. Muzzle the gun, and you muzzle the citizen. Restrict the gun, and you restrict the owner. Outlaw the gun, and you criminalize the American and defy God. The very idea of increased firearms restrictions was resisted as oppression. Don't tread on me. This attitude was perhaps best represented on bumper stickers and T-shirts bearing the words, "I'll give you my gun when you pry it from my cold, dead hands." Charlton Heston himself used the "cold, dead hands" line on several occasions, including his retirement speech from the NRA in 2003. On that last day, Heston held a rifle above his head in defiance as the adoring crowd cheered. The moment was uniquely American, and his defiant war cry echoes today. Large-scale gun violence has become a common American headline. The year 1999 saw the murder of 13 students by two fellow classmates at Columbine High School in Colorado. And the United States began down the long and tragic road of the normalized mass shooting, including 32 dead and 17 wounded on the campus of Virginia Tech in 2007. 18 people, including U.S. House Representative Gabrielle Giffords, shot in Tucson, Arizona, January the 8th, 2011. July 20th of the next year, 12 slain and 58 wounded at an Aurora, Colorado movie theater. The Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre of 20 kids on December 14, 2012. 49 killed and 53 wounded in an Orlando gay nightclub on June the 12th, 2016. The following year, in Las Vegas, a mass shooter killed 58 and injured 851. February 14th, Valentine's Day, 2018. 17 dead, 17 wounded at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. After the August 4th, 2019 mass shooting in Dayton, Ohio, killing 9 and injuring 17, Fox News host Sean Hannity offered his own solution to America's mass shooting problem: more guns. On the day after the murders, Hannity proposed that schools and retailers surround their facilities with ex-police and retired military personnel. Quote, "They should be on the floor of every school." Hannity suggested that we compensate these armed guards by exempting them from income, state, and federal taxes. He'd suggested a similar plan in 2018 after the Parkland shooting. Hannity rebuffed all notions of gun reform as an infringement on the rights of hundreds of millions of Americans. This good guy with a gun reasoning was ostensibly validated on December 28, 2019, after Keith Thomas Cunanan opened fire at West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement, Texas, and was shot dead by the church's head of security, who was armed. Two parishioners had been killed, but gun advocates declared that things could have been much worse, and they rallied around the Texas case as a real-world example proving the necessity of protective firearms. Strangely, nobody seemed interested in the larger question surrounding that tragic day. Why would a house of omnipotent God require armed security? And why did God not protect his own children against the evil assassin? Deuteronomy 31:6 promises he will never leave you or forsake you. Isaiah 54:17 proudly proclaims to the faithful that, quote, no weapon formed against you shall prosper. Psalm 46:1 calls God our refuge and strength, an ever-present help in trouble. The New Testament book of 2 Thessalonians promises that the Lord is faithful, and he will strengthen you and protect you from the evil one. Now, I'm not trying to build a soapbox upon the caskets of the dead, but I feel compelled to examine the contradictory notions of divine protection and the carrying of guns for personal defense. The biblical God has unlimited ability, as declared in Jeremiah 32:17. Ah, sovereign Lord, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. Nothing is too hard for you. God's children rest in the cradle of his embrace and are commanded, do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your request to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. That's Philippians 4, verses 6 and 7. Now, contrast pulpit proclamations about protection and peace against the rampant fear that seems to permeate Christian culture. Believers lay claim to God's ever-present help in trouble, even as they lock their doors, install their home alarm systems, monitor their security cameras, prime their mace cans, and load their firearms. The divinely protected avoid the dark alley, the stranger, the sketchy situation. Despite all the lofty talk about ever-present help, they warily behave as if calamity could strike at any moment. For all practical purposes, they act like non-believers. The contradictions continue among gun advocates who trumpet the global superiority of their great nation and its military, while simultaneously warning that they might someday have to revolt against it. They brandish their guns as a safety measure against tyranny. In March of 2018, National Rifle Association liaison Shannon Alford said as much to USA Today, quote, the Second Amendment is not about hunting. It is not about competitive shooting. The Second Amendment is about self-defense. It's about being able to stop people who would do you harm, whether that's a criminal or the government. Alford spoke in advance of the National March for Our Lives rallies, anti-gun demonstrations organized by surviving students of the Parkland shooting. Those rallies drew more than 2 million participants. In response, National Rifle Association television host Grant Stitchfield called the protesters radicals with a history of violent threats, language, and actions, further propagating the claim that gun control advocates and even victims were dangerous to American liberty. These sentiments are echoes of politicians like Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn, who declared, quote, the Second Amendment wasn't written so you can go hunting. It was to create a force to balance a tyrannical force here. It's a strange rallying cry, isn't it? The United States is the greatest nation, and we have to protect ourselves from it. As an exercise, let's allow that the militia crowd has a valid argument. Let's decide that everyday citizens might someday have to rise up in arms against their own government after a coup. Let's accept the claim that the president and both houses of Congress would collude in tyranny against the whole of the American population, and that 1.2 million active military men and women would then follow suit, denying all conscience, turning on their American brothers and sisters, and gliding into lockstep as revolutionaries. Even if those ridiculous ideas were true, the common American gun owner would face absolute extermination. These small bands of armchair warriors would discharge their puny Glocks and Remingtons into a billions of dollars blitzkrieg of war technology that could melt whole nations to glass. They'd make George Custer look like General William Halsey. Their defeat would be quick, humiliating, and total. What drives this lousy argument in defense of firearms? Well, I'm not clairvoyant, but I can assess the disposition and the claims of the NRA crowd, and I can crawl back into the attitudes of my youth with some objectivity. My parents had guns in the home, but we weren't avid shooters. My father and I would occasionally target soda cans with his .22 rifle, and he owned a .410 shotgun. My mother had a small caliber handgun hidden in her bedroom closet, but I never saw her carry a pistol until she took one out of her purse to show it off about 15 years ago. It was unloaded. She was nervous about accidental discharge, and I stared blankly as she fumbled for over a minute to find the stray bullets tumbling around the bottom of her handbag. Apparently, her gun would come in handy if she were ever mugged by a sloth. At the time, she was a retired woman in her 60s, but she had long supported personal firearms for protection. Her world always seemed a dangerous one, and she felt empowered by the hardware. Her gun was also a statement, a defiant demonstration of her Second Amendment liberties. For many years, I assumed her attitude on the subject. Now, for just a moment, let's go back in time to examine American firearms during the time that the Second Amendment was instituted. Let's assess an 18th century framework for a well-regulated militia. It was the time of the Revolutionary War. It was the time of the Pennsylvania Long Rifle, the famed firearm of pioneer Daniel Boone. Before every pull of the trigger, black powder would be poured from a horn into a charger, and the bullet, which was a lead ball the size of a pea, would be wrapped in a greased patch and rammed down the barrel. Loading was difficult, and the powder often clogged the barrel. The wooden stocks were known to break on heavy impact. Early versions of the Pennsylvania rifle managed approximately one shot per minute. The maximum effective range was 300 yards. The flintlock pistol was a clumsy handgun with a 12-inch barrel. Firing required a piece of flint that had to be sparked to ignite the powder. The guns were terribly inaccurate, and they were prone to misfire. The long loading process usually allowed only one shot during a close-quarters firefight before hand-to-hand combat became necessary. These examples are just two snapshots of America's early gun technology. Certainly, the Founding Fathers couldn't have imagined anything like the modern-day AR-15, which fires 45 rounds per minute at a muzzle velocity of more than 3,000 feet per second. Also, colonial militias existed during a fluid and volatile time in America's history, as Great Britain waged war against this new nation. But even those militias remained accountable to the Massachusetts Provisional Congress Committee of Safety and the umbrella authority of government. They were not intended to unleash autonomous farmers pointing rifles toward fellow citizens at their own discretion. In America's recent history, hate groups like the Ku Klux Klan have used the well-regulated militia argument to justify white supremacy and the rejection of laws they consider to be un-American, often using gun violence to force minorities back into the shadows. The far-right militia group, the Three Percenters, is an anti-government organization founded during the tenure of President Barack Obama, its name referring to the 3% of American colonists who fought the British during the Revolutionary War. The Three Percenters reflect a common militia claim that Democratic presidents, left-wing radicals, and even the United Nations seek a new world order, a world without borders or national sovereignty. The New York Times published a February 12, 2018 profile of the Atomwaffen Division, a neo-Nazi organization linked to several murders across the U.S. By the way, Atomwaffen translates to atomic weapons in German. That organization claims that the United States government has already gone rogue, and it anoints itself a resistance force against the American oligarchy. Members of the Arkansas State Militia Corps pose in military camouflage and train for battle with paintball guns. The scene would be comical if it wasn't so scary. Now, in fairness, these are fringe groups. And again, many American gun owners are not drinking the Kool-Aid of conspiracy, but they often share the militia's fears about progressive encroachments on their fierce nationalist notions, convinced that traitorous liberal foes must be resisted, even with force. For many, weapons like the AR-15 could back that resistance. But where does this conspiratorial thinking come from? New York University published an interesting 2008 study by several renowned psychologists from NYU, Berkeley, Cambridge, and the University of Texas at Austin, titled The Secret Lives of Liberals and Conservatives, Personality Profiles, Interaction Styles, and the Things They Leave Behind. The study examined the, quote, psychological needs, motives, and orientations toward the world, and it revealed striking differences in how conservatives and liberals think and behave. In the research, conservatives were usually more reserved, more attracted to in-group symbols like flags and sports memorabilia, more organized, more structured, and less drawn to the chic and trendy. They also had a greater tendency toward xenophobia, the fear of outsiders, a trait that attracted many to the strong nationalist rhetoric of Donald Trump. Trump's America was one of protective walls and distrust of the immigrant. Trump attempted the Muslim ban and would consider registering Muslims in a national database. His America was reflected in right-wing magazines like The New American, which ran the story, "Will Migrant Caravan Kill Your Child with Disease?" Fox and Friends host Brian Kilmeade helped to propagate those fears by asking his guest David Ward about possible danger. Ward replied, quote, "They're coming in with diseases such as smallpox and leprosy and TB that are going to infect our people in the United States." By the way, smallpox was globally eradicated in 1980. In his book, Sex, Power, and Partisanship, psychologist Hector Garcia further explains that these insular, tribal tendencies are statistically more common among conservatives worldwide. Researchers found that conservatives in Spain hold more anti-Arab prejudice than liberals. A much larger study called the Eurobarometer Study assessed predictors of out-group prejudice in 4,000 respondents across four European countries. The French were asked about the North Africans, Vietnamese, and Cambodians, the Dutch about Surinamers and Turks, the Brits about West Indians, Indians, and Pakistani. And predictors' political conservatism was the major predictor of out-group prejudice. Garcia goes on to reveal that conservatives tend to be more germophobic than liberals and are more easily disgusted by things that exist beyond their established norms. Everything from exotic foods to sexual behaviors to spiders to foreigners. Garcia's book explores possible genetic causes for this impulse toward disgust, and it's a hugely revealing journey into the forces fueling America's two major political ideologies. This much is certain: one camp is much more prone to experiencing a fear of the other. The National Rifle Association has deftly targeted those fears. The NRA spent more than $5 million on lobbying in 2017. That same year, official spokesperson Dana Lash appeared in an NRA video ad accusing gun opponents as being national saboteurs who, quote, slashing away with their leaks and sneers, their phony accusations and gagging sanctimony, drive their daggers through the hearts of our future. Lash finished the ad by predicting that liberals' fate will be failure, quote, and they will perish in the political flames of their own fires. A February 2018 ad showed Dana Lash turning an hourglass, the spilling sand sending a clear message to anti-gun Americans. Your time is running out. These implied threats played quite well to paranoid gun owners. So what's the good news? The National Rifle Association's efforts to block responsible new gun legislation seems to be waning against public opinion. Politico recently reported internal conflict at the NRA. The organization's president, Oliver North, was ousted in early 2019 after an extortion scheme that took place on his watch. The NRA was revealed to have ties to Maria Butina, the Russian agent convicted of infiltrating American gun rights groups. Several NRA board members resigned in August 2019 over reports of mismanagement and lavish spending. A recent Fox News poll, go figure, revealed a negative public opinion rating for the first time in NRA history. Half of all U.S. states passed at least one gun control measure in 2018. Yet the NRA's influence and the guns versus tyranny narrative bleeds literally into the 21st century, as the organization aggressively lobbies to block further research and data on gun violence. Perhaps you find me a hypocrite. I've already admitted to owning firearms and keeping them in my home. I received firearms training. I target shoot. And although the prospect grieves me greatly, I am prepared to use lethal force against a home intruder. But my guns aren't part of my national identity or my human one, and I'm not threatened by proposals that could potentially reduce the whiz of lethal bullets in this country. I resist all claims that a government unable to agree on the basics, same-sex marriage, abortion, immigration, climate change, the economy, the military, foreign policy, could ever sink into a unified oppression of its own people. And I'm heartbroken about those slain in the streets, the schools, the nightclubs, the churches, the culture. Almost 40,000 U.S. gun victims every single year. It's a messy situation. The 800-pound gorilla is well out of its cage, and the ubiquity of guns is a problem not soon solved. Gun advocates have a valid point when they protest that mental health is a factor in some gun homicides and that stricter gun laws will have no effect on criminals who ignore the laws, restricting only the law-abiding. Gun opponents have a valid point when they reveal that mental health issues aren't precursors for violent behavior and don't result in equivalent gun violence in other nations. Anti-gun advocates also correctly note that fewer overall firearms would statistically result in fewer gun incidents, and that there's no good reason for civilians to possess military-grade assault weapons. This position becomes even more compelling against the fact that most weapons used in U.S. mass shootings were obtained legally. At the very least, we can and should embrace these realities. The United States has more guns per capita than any other country. Gun homicide rates are 25% higher in the U.S. than in other wealthy countries. The United States has the second highest number of global mass shooters, surpassed only by Yemen. Modern weapons were developed several centuries after the writing of the Second Amendment. And as the March for Our Lives demonstrates, the American population is increasingly desperate to put a stop to the carnage, even if it means surrendering its guns in the name of public safety. Beyond the logistics, it's time for Americans to evolve past the paranoid attitudes that fuel much of the gun culture, expanding their horizons, dropping their guard, having a little more faith in their fellow human beings, and adopting a more xenophilic attitude toward those of different political parties, races, cultures, religions, and borders. Yes, there are dangerous people platforming dangerous ideas. Yes, we must be vigilant. But there are so many instances of tribal isolation and unfounded fears that it seems obvious that the whole world could see much clearer from a more charitable vantage. We are all part of the diverse, fragile, precious human condition. And unfounded paranoia only compounds the divisions between us. Okay, that's just my take on firearms. I hope this has provided fodder for discussion. Let us discuss, let us exchange ideas in good faith, and work towards solutions to our many, many problems when it comes to gun violence. And I hope we can certainly do so in good faith. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you back here next time.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter. For a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring the Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming Freethought events and conventions, log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.